Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the February meeting of the Talk of Iowa Book Club. We've been reading The Queen's Gambit by Walter Tevis. It's a novel first published in 1983 that is suddenly on the New York Times bestseller list thanks to the hit Netflix series based on the book. There is a live discussion going on right now in IPR's Talk of Iowa Book Club Facebook group, and you are welcome to join in. The Queen's Gambit begins with 8-year-old Beth Harmon arriving at an orphanage in Kentucky following the death of her mother in a car accident. The orphanage is a cold, uncaring place where she and the other children are fed tranquilizers to keep them docile. The only saving grace is that Beth discovers chess and an unlikely teacher, the gruff janitor Mr. Scheibel, who holds court in the dank, dark basement. The rest of the book follows Beth as her extraordinary chess skills grow. She is adopted, she becomes the Kentucky chess champion, and moves on to competing on the world stage. All the while, she struggles with addiction and isolation. Here's author Walter Tevis reading an excerpt from the book in a 1983 interview on NPR's All Things Considered.
There were more people gathered in the top boards room than before. As games ended, they came in to watch the finals. She pushed by them, stepped over the rope, and sat down. Her hands were perfectly steady, and her stomach and eyes felt fine. She reached out and moved. She punched the clock firmly. Beltic studied the move for a few minutes and then took her knight with his bishop, as she knew he would. She did not retake. She brought a bishop over to attack one of his rooks. He moved the rook out of the line of fire. He had to. She felt the blood rush into her cheeks as she brought her queen from the back to the center of the board. It now threatened to take the rook, pin the king's knight pawn, and could take the bishop with a check. She looked at Beltic. He was studying the board and rolling up his sleeves. His clock was ticking.
That's an excerpt from The Queen's Gambit, read by Walter Tevis, who died of lung cancer the year after the book was published. Beth Harmon's experience in that terrible orphanage may seem too awful to be true, but as Tevis shared in that 1983 interview, that part of the book was inspired by his own life.
Beth's experience, to some extent, is drawn on my own. When I was a child, I was put in a convalescent hospital because I was diagnosed as having heart trouble. And I found that that institution, which was presumably dedicated to taking care of the young, was in many ways, for me, very damaging. It was a frightening and damaging experience.
Tevis was abandoned by his parents at that hospital for a year. They finally sent him a train ticket, and at the age of 11, he traveled solo from California to Kentucky to rejoin his family. There are other parallels between Tevis's life and Beth Harmon's. He also struggled with addiction for many years. Tevis went to the University of Kentucky. He published his first novel, a hit, called The Hustler, in 1959. He graduated from the Iowa Writers' Workshop in 1960. He went on to publish 5 more novels, and he taught English literature and creative writing at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, for many years. But his path was not easy or straightforward. For a time in the 1960s, he basically dropped out of society to gamble, drink, and play pool in Mexico. He got sober and fell in love with chess in the early 70s, and in 1974 published an article in the Atlantic Monthly based on his experience competing and losing dramatically at the National Open in Las Vegas. I have invited 3 expert readers to be part of today's book club in a moment. Author Rachel Yoder and psychologist and chess player Heidi Pierce will be here. But first, Lauren Glass is professor and chair of the Department of English at the University of Iowa. Lauren, hello.
Hello. Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. And this book was new to you. Give me some of your first impressions.
Well, it's a riveting book, although like with The Hustler, you have to follow a lot of technical descriptions of competition, which somehow are still enormously suspenseful, even though you might not understand entirely what's going on. But like all of Tevis's books, it's expertly written. It's flawless.
The book gives you such a very close look at Beth Harmon and her experiences. It's not written from her perspective, but I feel like he helps us really understand her and her psychology. And that's part of what makes him a really skilled writer. Tell me more about what he's doing there.
Well, Tevis, like any skilled novelist, is very talented at deploying what we call close third narration, which is you're writing in the third person, but you use idioms and punctuation to indicate that you're actually really expressing the thoughts and feelings of the main character. And if you read any of the openings of Tevis's book, he immediately plunges into the mind of the protagonist, Fast Eddie Felsen in The Hustler, Thomas Newton in The Man Who Fell to Earth, who's not even a man, right? Not even a person, but yet still you immediately get a sense of his consciousness, his psychology, his fears, and his hopes. And this is handled through that a deft deployment of this narrative technique that really is a necessary method for any accomplished writer. It's certainly taught here at Iowa, although I'm not sure that this is where Tevis actually learned it. If we look at Tevis's time here in Iowa, about which, by the way, there's very little information, he, of course, got his MFA here in 1960 for a thesis called The Hustler. But mysteriously enough, The Hustler as a novel was published prior to his arrival in Iowa. I'm still trying to clear up this, what appears to be either a contradiction or a scam in his career as a MFA recipient.
That seems believable somehow. He was a man who lived pretty close to the edge is what we learn. And of course, he had this early in his writing career, this tremendous success with The Hustler that was then turned into a major motion picture starring Paul Newman, who could not have been a bigger star at that time. I mean, it really looked like he was set to be the major author of the moment, didn't it?
Exactly. It was a smash hit. The movie was made soon after the publication of the book, which was well received. Yet Tevis seemed to still actually want to be a teacher. And indeed, based on what little information I've been able to find, his ex-wife did write some autobiographical reminiscences that were published in 1990, which states that his original plan was actually to come to Iowa to get a PhD because he knew he would need that in order to teach English. But he couldn't apparently navigate the language requirements. So instead, he, I guess, retreated in order to get an MFA. I'm going to assume he wanted to get a creative dissertation, which were just coming into sort of fashion, at least in Iowa at that time. But it doesn't look like it worked out the way that he wanted it to.
In writing in this novel, in writing about Beth Harmon, he does create this incredibly compelling character at the center of the book. How do you feel about how he describes other characters? I mean, it feels to me like Beth Harmon is so developed and many of the other characters, not nearly as much.
Well, that's true for The Hustler as well. And indeed, Tevis does seem to have a fascination with individual and usually exceptional or solitary protagonists, folks with great talent, but also folks with a sense of solitude and isolation that is carried through, I think, in the method of narration and in the plot, so that the other characters all feel subordinated to the major character, such that they would be, you know, what used to be called more flat characters or stock characters, who feel like they're there more to support the story of the main character than to be fully independent. The one exception that I know to this is The Man Who Fell to Earth, very interestingly, actually leaps from different characters' point of views in a way that creates more of an ensemble feel around the mysterious Thomas Newton. But yeah, I would say that Beth Harmon is the only fully shaped character, although he does have a sense of appealing types, might we say. So her stepmother, I find to be, or her adoptive mother, is a compelling figure, as are the other chess experts with whom she comes into contact.
Well,
but there's no doubt that they, yeah.
He also obviously loved chess and wrote deeply about chess. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more later on because we have a chess player who's going to join us in a couple of minutes. But I also was struck by his use of symbolism and how much he enjoyed playing with the symbolism in chess. There's this just
gorgeous moment in the novel where Beth is playing a rival. She's playing Benny, who comes along a little bit later on. And this is the second time she's played him. And he takes her queen early on in the game. And this is shortly after Beth has lost her adoptive mother. And I just found that, in spite of the fact that I don't understand the chess at all, that his use of symbolism was really stunning and riveting there.
Well, of course, it's called The Queen's Gambit. So in a sense, the entire novel in its title invites us to think about chess, both as an objective game with pieces and strategies, and as a sort of symbolic repository, specifically for what's, obviously most striking about this novel, which is that it takes a plot and a character type, which is traditionally masculine, going at least back through Hemingway, and indeed the plot arc of Queen's Gambit is point for point quite similar to The Hustler, but to focus around a female competitor. So it's quite powerful in that way. And I think, as you note, the symbolism of chess, in which, of course, the queen — I don't know much about chess, but I do know the queen is the most powerful piece — surely supports that symbolic element.
In learning more about Tevis and in reading this novel, I just find myself being sad, because it does feel like we missed out on having a great American novelist with us for many years because of his addiction and then succumbing to cancer.
Well, he was obviously an addictive personality and a reckless and apparently a great raconteur, too, very much a sort of pool room hangout, hangout type of person. And indeed, his wife says that he was, in fact, not a terribly disciplined writer. He was more of a dissolute kind of talker, drinker, smoker, with occasional sort of
bursts,
moments
of genius,
periods, yeah, of productivity. Yeah, exactly.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me right now is Lauren Glass. He is professor and chair of the Department of English at the University of Iowa. Our other expert readers will be joining us in a moment. Author Rachel Yoder, her highly anticipated debut novel, Night Bitch, comes out in July. She'll be here along with Heidi Pierce, who is the Women and Girls Coordinator for the Iowa State Chess Association. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight — that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. We've been reading The Queen's Gambit by Walter Tevis, published in 1983, but suddenly very popular thanks to the hit Netflix show based on the book. The book follows chess prodigy Beth Harmon as she develops her skills, faces hardship, and fights with addiction. Lauren Glass is here. He is professor and chair of the Department of English at the University of Iowa. Heidi Pierce is also here now, the Women and Girls Coordinator for the Iowa State Chess Association. She's also a psychology professor at Kirkwood Community College, which also helps in understanding this novel. Heidi, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you for being here. And it was the chess that drew you into this novel. Tell me about your first impressions.
Well, I enjoyed reading this book, partly because I love chess, and also because I love the idea of a book about a woman who refused to conform to gender norms. Beth had a traumatic childhood, she battled substance use disorders, and also worked hard to achieve her dreams. She struggled. She had setbacks, but she never gave up on herself. So I just really enjoyed it for all of those reasons.
Well, and we will dig into a lot of those different themes that you mentioned in just a few minutes. Also, I want to introduce our other expert reader, Rachel Yoder. She is an author living in Iowa City. Her highly anticipated debut novel, Night Bitch, comes out in July, and it's also slated to become a major movie starring Amy Adams. Hello, Rachel.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And tell me what your first impressions of the book were. Again, we invited you to be part of the show, and that's what led you to read The Queen's Gambit. So this is new to you.
Yes. And, you know, I was absolutely taken by it from the opening paragraphs, just kind of looking at it as a writer, at a expert craftsman, crafting something that was nearly perfect. I mean, the narrative economy of it and the precision of the plot were just amazing to experience. And then I was also, like everyone, just fell in love with Beth Harmon and with her character, and was really moved by her and her experience in ways I'm not often moved by books, actually.
Well, let's talk more about Beth, because she is such a singular character, and she is such a troubled individual, such a damaged individual by so much of what she's gone through. And you just feel her throughout the entire novel, not quite connecting, not quite interacting with society like most of us do, not feeling the emotions that most of us would feel in some of these situations. Rachel, what about this character connected with you so strongly?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually astonished by her character in a good way and sort of exhilarated by how she was written, because you just don't see portrayals of women all that often as they are portrayed in this book. I mean, Beth Harmon is a woman who is single-minded in her pursuit of success. She's competitive, she's ambitious, she's intense, she gets angry. She unapologetically wants things, and she doesn't, as Heidi said, feel constrained necessarily by the social norms and the sort of gendered expectations that often constrain women and female characters in books. And there's this great moment where we get to see what her kind of vision of success is. And if I could just read it,
sure.
It's wonderful. It like really kind of opened up the character for me. Sometimes she would visualize herself as what she wanted to become, a truly professional woman and the finest chess player in the world, traveling confidently by herself in the first class cabins of airplanes, tall, perfectly dressed, good looking and poised. For every little girl who has ever been dazzled by the power of her own mind and her own capabilities, this image of Beth Harmon, I think, really resonates, right? To have this sort of vision of yourself as successful, independent, with intellectual purpose, to be taken seriously and to be able to have these serious grown-up ambitions. And in these ways, Beth was really this sort of, like I said, astonishing, exhilarating character who I hadn't met before in the pages of a book.
And did she feel real to you? Did she resonate with you as a real human being, Rachel?
She did. I mean, she's definitely perhaps not, you know, she's on, her reactions are maybe on a spectrum that is a little different than how I, for instance, process emotions or process experience. But yeah, she felt incredibly real to me. And I was really grateful that, you know, there are lots of ways to be a woman, and Beth Harmon is one of those ways.
Heidi, I would love to get your thoughts about Beth Harmon. Again, I mentioned that you have a psychology background, so that plays into this as well. She struggles with substance abuse. She is a child who receives basically no nurturing, no love throughout the period of time that we see her. What were your thoughts reading about Beth Harmon?
We know essentially nothing about her father. I think the only message, only information about her father was that she had heard her mother call her father a bastard. but her, you know, she was alone when her mom died in a car accident at age 8, being home alone. So that tells us that even before she comes to the orphanage, there might have been a lack of caregiving. But really, once she gets there, the only comfort she received was from those tranquilizers. They helped her sleep. And there was a sentence I made note of on page 7. She swallowed the 2 pills and lay back until the ease began to spread through her body like the waves of a warm sea. So taking that and the terror she felt when she learned that she wasn't going to get those tranquilizers anymore, that then led to her overdose, and how that carried on throughout her life. But we think about that punitive discipline that happened at the orphanage. Mrs. Deerdorf was a very menacing character who threatened physical violence if a child received 10 demerits. And when Beth misbehaved, took everything from her, her playground privileges, her library privileges, chess. Yeah, so she really did lack nurturing. Mr. Scheibel taught her chess, and that was great, but one of the first sentences he made said to her was, "Girls don't play chess." And then when he finally decided that he was going to let her play a game, she needed to get to geometry class, and he said, "Well, it's now or never."
Right.
He gets mad at her when she calls him greedy after losing to him with what in the chess world we consider very unsportsmanlike conduct, that scholar's mate, put someone in checkmate in just a few moves if they're not familiar with it. And when I'm coaching chess, I always tell the kids to avoid that as a strategy because it isn't unsportsmanlike. And so she was upset. She's a little girl and upset, and I think rightfully so.
Well, tell me what your impressions are about the substance abuse in the book, because I mean, we know that Walter Tevis was an addict himself, and I felt like he wrote about addiction beautifully, with incredible empathy and understanding. Heidi?
Yeah, I think he did a good job with that as well. You know, self-medicating for insomnia came up throughout the book. And I think, you know, obviously I can't diagnose a fictional character, but there were definite indicators there of anxiety with the physical manifestations, even as early as childhood, where she had the taste of vinegar in her mouth, you know, the stomach upset. And so using those tranquilizers, but then writing too, that when she took them before a chess game, it took her an hour or so to, you know, clear her mind. There is that hangover from Librium and the other benzodiazepines that if you take it at night, they can kind of lead to what's very similar to a hangover you would get from drinking alcohol.
Yeah, I did find myself looking up side effects of Librium and wondering what that would do to a person to take it that much for that long, especially during a time when she's a growing girl and, developing into womanhood. And Lauren, I know you have some thoughts about the addiction in the novel as well.
Well, what interests me is the way the addiction seems to correlate with the talent and the addiction with competition. I think in both this book and in The Hustler, and I believe in his own life as well, Tevis saw a relationship between exceptionally talented people and addictive behavior and competition, right? The focus on chess. As on the one hand, sort of a corollary of the addiction, but on the other hand, as a sort of complementary or alternative, right? Like if she were able to really focus on the chess, she would be able to get off the pills and possibly vice versa, right? She has that whole alcoholic skid out at the end, toward the end, in response to that loss to the Russians. So I think there's a thematically speaking, Tevis is interested in addiction specifically in relation to this kind of exceptional, talented individual.
Well, and I know in just talking about the book with other people, some people felt like, it looked like her addiction actually helped her. And, I think that's part of the addictive cycle for so many people. It did feel like it helped her at first, but of course, it also could have destroyed her eventually. And I felt like Tevis did a beautiful job laying that out. Lauren?
Absolutely. Well, you know, he did die of lung cancer and was a chain smoker and an alcoholic, as well as a talented writer. So I think in his own experience, he may have been trying to answer questions about his own temperament and talent, right? What is the relationship between his writerly abilities and his obsessions or his flaws?
Let's talk about gender and its role in this book. Heidi, I know you were already bringing that up. Rachel, you brought that up as well, to see a woman character in this role and, you know, doing what she's doing so beautifully fleshed out, knowing, of course, that this book was published in 1983. So that puts it in perspective a little bit. But I have seen a lot of people comment that they don't understand why Beth doesn't behave more like a feminist. Why is she not proud of the fact that she is the first woman, the first girl, then the first woman to do all of these things? What were your thoughts, Rachel, about where feminism comes into play in the novel?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I really resonated with her wanting to be sort of taken seriously for her own talent and skill, and to have that story told about her. I mean, there's this great line where, see, of course I can't find it now in all my quotes, but this great line where she's being compared to another famous female chess player, and she says something like, you know, I'm not just better than the other female chess player, and better than all the men too. And why don't they focus on that? And there, I found it very interesting to watch the sort of progression of how reporters talk to her and the stories that they tell about her. And it's not really until she's the world champion that they really hear the story that she wants to tell, you know, about Mr. Scheibel and about learning to play chess in an orphanage basement. Before that, you know, they want to ask her about boys, and they want to, you know, ask her about her other interests and whether, you know, chess is really a serious undertaking. And so she doesn't really get that kind of get taken seriously in the way she wants to be until she's achieved, you know, world-class success. Yeah, and there were just, I mean, I just was really taken too with like the little moments where, you know, she doesn't have an agenda other than to be an amazing chess player. You know, feminism isn't really her cause. But she is sort of just a feminist in how she behaves. I love the moment where she throws away the doll that she gets from the chess club director. I love at the Apple Pie Club meeting where Tevis writes, she was astounded at the dullness of the evening. So it was just, you know, she's not necessarily written with some kind of cause behind her, but her actions embody a sort of inherent feminism.
Well, and I felt like in many ways she can't see beyond herself and her own experience. So almost thinking about herself as a feminist or leading other women isn't something that she can really comprehend. I mean, Heidi, of course, chess is still a very male-dominated sport. What were your thoughts?
It is. Right now, only about 2% of the world's grandmasters are women. There has never been a female world champion. And in fact, there's only been one female on the top 10 FIDE list, Judith Polgar. So FIDE is a French acronym for the International Chess Federation or the World Chess Association. So the current FIDE rating list only has 15% women. So it is definitely a male-dominated sport.
So this the novel is groundbreaking in a number of ways. There, I actually, where I really was thinking about feminism and how women, especially in the time that this novel takes place, were really trapped by this patriarchal society, was largely in reading about Alma Wheatley, Mrs. Wheatley, the adoptive mother of Beth. And Lauren, I know you mentioned earlier that you found her character to be very compelling, and she was so trapped by this patriarchal culture.
Indeed, and actually, as you're speaking, I'm thinking there may be a generational story there in terms of a woman born and raised before second wave feminism or women's lib, and a woman after. Beth, I think we could say is not in and of herself a feminist in a political sense, but I do think that Tavis was aware of the context in which he was writing. I have a quote here from an interview that he did for the Times when the book came out, and he notes, "Actually, I consider the Queen's Gambit a tribute to brainy women. I like Beth for her bravery and intelligence. In the past, many women have had to hide their brains, but not today." So I think even though obviously patriarchal pressures were still quite salient and strong in the 80s, I think he was aware of writing a book that he couldn't have written in the same way in the 60s, right? So The Hustler is his 60s book, and he seems to have had a deliberate idea to track some of the changes in society over that time by focusing on a female protagonist, which he basically puts into a plot structure which had previously been dominated by men.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This is the February meeting of the Talk of Iowa Book Club. With me this hour, Lauren Glass, professor and chair of the Department of English at the University of Iowa. Heidi Pierce, women and girls coordinator for the Iowa State Chess Association. She's also a psychology professor at Kirkwood Community College. And Rachel Yoder, an author living in Iowa City. Her highly anticipated debut novel, Night Bitch, comes out in July. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. We've been reading The Queen's Gambit by Walter Tevis, published in 1983. Now it's on the New York Times bestseller list because of the Netflix series based on the book. The book, of course, follows chess prodigy Beth Harmon as she develops her skills, she faces hardship, she fights with addiction, and overcomes so much of that, leaving us hopefully feeling hopeful at the end of the novel. With me, I have three expert readers today. Lauren Glass, professor and chair of the Department of English at the University of Iowa. Heidi Pierce is the women and girls coordinator for the Iowa State Chess Association and a psychology professor at Kirkwood Community College. And Rachel Yoder, an author who lives in Iowa City. Her debut novel, Night Bitch, will come out in July. It is also slated to become a major movie starring Amy Adams. And before the break, we were talking about the character of Alma Wheatley, and we were talking about the role that gender plays in this book. And Alma Wheatley is, of course, the adoptive mother of Beth. She also suffers with addiction. She has been abandoned by her husband. One of the really frustrating things about this character for me, Heidi, was that finally we have a character who does do some nurturing of Beth, but she doesn't really start to nurture her or care for her until she realizes what she can get from her. And that was really hard for me as a reader. Heidi?
Agreed. I did not find her a likable character at all. You know, she was an addict, so I have some empathy, you know, with the way she was treated by her husband and all that. But it almost felt like she was using Beth. She relied on her financially when she was a child. She, you know, was not a good role model when she was lying to the school about why Beth was missing school. Beth even had the sense as a little child to think, why don't we just tell them the truth? They'll probably give me an excused absence. However, Beth, when thinking back on Mrs. Wheatley, considers her a, quote, good mother. So I think that just shows how low the bar was because she had such a lonely childhood.
Yeah. And I mean, Beth, she uses Beth, but Beth needs her to use her. Beth couldn't have been able to do the things that she did if it wasn't for Mrs. Wheatley actually taking an interest and using her. But I just found her to be such an incredibly tragic character as well. And I want to move on because I want to talk about Jolene. And Jolene is a character that we first meet in the orphanage. She is a little bit older than Beth, maybe 3 or 4 years older than Beth. She's a Black child, and she's an angry, brilliant, beautiful, and gifted young lady, although just miserable in that orphanage. And she is stuck there. She never gets adopted. She graduates from high school while still living in the orphanage. And then she appears again later in the novel and really saves Beth on a lot of levels. And this is a character that I think isn't well fleshed out. This was the most troubling part of the novel for me. I think about what Spike Lee said back in 2001 when he coined the term magical Negro, where we have this character who's almost too good to be true, who appears in the novel, and her whole role is to save the white protagonist. And I think about all of the things that Jolene would have gone through, worse than what Beth went through. I mean, at least Beth was rescued from that orphanage to some degree, and she seems to be untouched by it. Rachel, why don't you weigh in? What were your thoughts about the character Jolene?
Yeah, I was really disappointed in this character. She did just feel sort of like a literary device, and never really transcended stereotype or trope in the book. And yeah, I think that Tevis, you know, he doesn't really get female friendship. That's something I kept coming back to, you know, that I feel like the dynamics of a female friendship, especially this particular one, and over so many years, could be a really like interesting, rich terrain, especially between a white woman and a black woman. But he just, you know, kind of glazes over it. We see her at the beginning, and then she just, oh, there she is. Look, here again at the end, to kind of like fill a plot hole. Yeah. And so even I love the book, and I think he's an amazing writer, but that the character of Jolene really fell short for me.
Lauren, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would only agree. I mean, everyone, the idea that Jolene is silly, purely sort of functional relative to Beth is something that everyone, I think, perceives. And of course, the sort of deus ex machina or whatever, having her come and save her at the end, is one of the few moments in the novel that really does feel contrived. I would only add that one of the, I think, to get a full sense of how Jolene and Mrs. Wheatley function is to contrast them with the somewhat surprising and unexpected nurturing and support she gets from the other male chess players, which some readers have said, and I think is correct, is a bit unrealistic, that no one seems to feel challenged by her, at least not exceptionally so, in terms of their own gender, and rather she gets a whole sort of cheerleading team from the men who she's defeated. So again, you get a constellation of characters who are compelling, but yet also subordinated to the main character, who, by the way, is a loner who has her own trouble relating. I mean, it's possible that Tevis was better at creating individuals than he was at creating relationships. There aren't that many successful relationships in his novels, either romantic or friendships. That may have been a problem that he himself had in his life as well.
Yeah, interesting. And I do want to, I think we've got a little controversy here when you talk about the chess world, because Heidi, you felt differently about the way that those men that she beat nurtured her and turned around and kind of rooted for her and even helped her develop her skills, right?
I did. So I have coached chess at elementary school level. I have sponsored a chess club in a prison. So I've seen chess in a variety of different venues. And I don't, when the two folks that are opponents are sitting across the chessboard from each other, there is that competition. But after the game is over, so often it's the person who wins who might be comforting the person who loses and saying, look, what if you had done this? So they kind of replay the game and they sit and have a conversation. And we really root for each other. So I can think of my son's class in, you know, in chess in Iowa, there were three boys who were all very good in my son's class. And when one of them would win and move on to play a game, you know, at the national level, everybody was excited for that person. So there is this camaraderie that happens in the chess community in Iowa anyway. Of course, we're not at the, you know, world championships or anything like this, but in Iowa, we are tight-knit. We know each other well. We travel to tournaments together. It's not unusual for parents to rotate who's bringing food or who's driving, who's supervising kids. And we all just want to see each other succeed. So you'll see kids coaching other kids. There were actually a couple of teenage girls here in Iowa who started what they called the Butterfly Chess Club. And they invited girls in kindergarten through second grade to come to this chess club. And they'd offer them little prizes if they could solve puzzles and learn tactics. And these girls just absolutely loved it. So this trying to bring more people in, because we love chess so much and we want to share the love, is what I've seen.
Well, I hope you're right about that. That makes me want to play chess, Heidi. And of course, I don't play chess. I didn't understand the chess in the book. As a chess player, Heidi, how does all of that chess read?
So the way that they take notation and talk about moving to the different squares on the chessboard is different from how we do it now. So now we number the rows from 1 to 8 on a chessboard. White always starts out on rows 1 and 2 and black on rows 7 and 8. And then the columns are labeled A through H. So whereas they were talking like maybe pawn to king, bishop, whatever, that was hard for me to follow because I would think of, you know, knight to square C3 or something like that. So it's different the way that we take chess notation now.
Okay, so maybe it was a little confusing even for you.
It was.
And although I don't understand chess, I was able to get the gist of what was going on all the time. And this is a sports book. I mean, in some ways, you think about some of the great novels you've read where athletes are at the center of it. Rachel, I mean, this reads like that in many ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was actually thinking about, you know, the chess matches in terms of the adaptation too of the book. So in a lot of ways, this book is sort of primed to be adapted for film because it's so external, right? We can see everything so clearly. I would say the one part in it that isn't is where we go into these chess matches and they're so internal, right? So they actually work better for me in the book than they might on screen, because the way Tevis writes them, we get to, you know, be in Beth's mind and see her kind of thought process and her strategizing. And they're so propulsive in that the scenes and how the chess games are written are always moving, much in the same way that, you know, Beth's mind is. So we get all her strategizing internally, then we move externally to maybe little mannerisms or the face of an opponent, and then we move to the audience. And then we have this wonderful vocabulary of battle that's used in the chess scenes. And the movie doesn't have that, right? Unless you do voiceover, which can often be clunky. And so it kept kind of returning to that visual chessboard on the ceiling because it didn't have that access that we did have in the novel.
And Lauren, you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, absolutely, because Rachel's comment really resonated with a sort of revelation or insight I had as I was reading through these books, which is that I think that Tevis ultimately is obsessed with something that some competitors call flow, which is where your mental image and the objective reality sync exactly and you know you're in power, right? So when you're on the tool table and you know that you can do anything you picture, or when you're in the chess game and you know that you can see every possibility, that is kind of the ideal of the competitive spirit, right? They're constantly thinking about the game, right? Beth is obsessed. She can't stop thinking about the game. The same with Eddie Felsen, constantly picturing moves. And the ideal is to have a moment where what you're picturing and what's going on actually overlap and happen. And I think that's why when you're reading, you can get excited even if you don't really understand what's happening, right? If you don't understand the moves, you still know that the player's mind has suddenly
synced exactly with the actual objective play, and that's the goal. That's what they're looking for. That's when they're in their kind of utopian space.
Yeah, and he does a beautiful job just heightening that tension, and you almost hold your breath while you're reading through to see what's going to happen next. And Lauren, I know that you've researched and written a lot about celebrity, which is such an unusual thing for humans to have to deal with. And here's Beth Harmon, who is emotionally stunted in so many ways, trying to make her way through the world. And then she gets treated differently than other human beings because she's a superstar. How do you think that plays into the plot?
Well, it's central to the plot of, I think, of all of Tavis's novels. In fact, I have another quote here which explained a lot to me from this Times article. I write about losers and loners. If there's a common theme in my work, that's it. I invented the phrase born loser in The Hustler, and in one way or another, I'm obsessed with the struggling between winning and losing. And one of the paradoxes of winning in the literary world and in contemporary America generally is you want recognition, and when you get it, you suddenly feel misrecognized. And as if, you know, the television and the reporters don't understand who you really are or what you're really doing. And indeed, Tevis was also obsessed with television. You don't see it as much in The Queen's Gambit, but it's all over A Man Who Fell to Earth. So I think that, like a lot of other American writers, Tevis was very interested in what you might call the paradox of celebrity, which is that before you're well-known, it's very much what you want. You're struggling to be recognized as someone who's good, someone who has talent. But once you get the recognition, it's this incredible deflation and disappointment when you realize that actually the celebrity machine doesn't really know who you are and creates a kind of separate being that you then have to struggle with or against. And I think Tevis was very interested in that and experienced it in some ways himself as a celebrity author.
Yeah, well, this book is one that moved me deeply when I read it. And I've also found myself, since I finished the novel, I return to it. I think about it. It's stuck with me in my brain. And Rachel, any thoughts about that? I mean, this is a powerful book.
Yeah, you know, I don't often find myself wondering what a character is up to or, you know, what comes next in their story. And I found myself really wanting a sequel to this and wanting to know who Beth Harmon becomes. I mean, we leave her in what? She's only 19, 20? I mean, she's very young. And there's that moment where she asks the young chess player she's playing against, you know, what happens after you become the best? And he's like, I don't understand your question. You know, she's like, what happens after you become the best chess player in the world? And he doesn't have a vision of that. And I want to know where Beth is and what she's up to.
Yeah, well, and only Beth Harmon would turn to a 10-year-old and ask that question as well. I wouldn't look to many 10-year-olds to guide me emotionally through my future. But I will say that I felt nervous about Beth at the end of the novel. But in listening back to that 1983 interview that we played a little bit of at the beginning of the show, Walter Tevis himself said that she felt like she was in a good place and headed in a good direction at the end of the novel. So I'm going to go ahead and take that from his lips and feel good about Beth Harmon's future. Rachel Yoder, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Rachel Yoder lives in Iowa City. Her highly anticipated debut novel, Night Bitch, comes out in July. Heidi Pierce, thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Heidi Pierce is the Women and Girls Coordinator for the Iowa State Chess Association. She's also a psychology professor at Kirkwood Community College. And Lauren Glass, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Lauren Glass is professor and chair of the Department of English at the University of Iowa. We have been talking about The Queen's Gambit by Walter Tevis. You can join in on the conversation in our Facebook group, IPR's Talk of Iowa Book Club. Just search for it. Join our conversation as we talk about this and many other books. I want to take a moment to say thank you to Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City for providing copies of the book for our guests today. Also, thank you to NPR for allowing us to air some of that 1983 interview with author Walter Tevis. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.